Okay, everyone, places. Showtime!
This is the Hollywood Outsider, a weekly movie and TV podcast, with a new episode every Tuesday. You can grab the hoe on the go by downloading the Apple or Android app, or you can listen at thehollywoodoutsider.com. We're on iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, wherever you choose to peruse your podcasting. My name is Aaron Peterson, and I'm your host, and I'm here today with my fellow host, Scott Clark.
Well, hey there. How you doing?
Well, hey there. How's it going? For this special episode of The Hollywood Outsider, we are interviewing director Darren Lynn Bousman. You may remember he directed the film Saw 2 through 4. That's right, 2, 3, and 4. And then he did Mother's Day, and he's done several other movies. Repo, The Genetic Opera. But he's here today to talk about, what is he here to talk about, Scott?
Alleluia, The Devil's Carnival.
Alleluia. I had to look that up several times on how to pronounce that. I still think I got it wrong. It's like hallelujah without the H, right?
I believe so.
Okay.
That's how I would pronounce it.
Well, it's an interesting concept. How would you describe it?
It's a rock opera musical.
Yeah, but, there you go.
Very dark, gritty. It's not what you're expecting from a musical.
It has some very otherworldly themes. It deals with God and the devil, and what if the devil did things a little differently than we might think. And he's trying to create an event. He did this with Repo, kind of by circumstance, as you'll hear in the interview. But this one, he's intentionally trying to create this event, cross-country film experience. I'd call it an event. I mean, he's trying to create an event.
Well, yeah, and for those familiar with something like Rocky Horror Picture Show, where if you ever do go to a theater screening and that, there's a lot of audience participation, and that's exactly what he's looking for, is he wants to make a theater presentation that gets the audience involved and gets them pumped and excited, but in a different way than Rocky Horror. Rocky Horror, even though it has horror in the title, I still think it's very upbeat.
If you watch this looks a little dark. Well, there's still some upbeatness.
There's some upbeat, too, but the theme is a little bit darker.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, Rocky Horror was pretty dark if you really... There's a lot of death and stuff.
Yes. There's also a lot of guys in pantyhose.
There was. That was your favorite part, too. It looks like a crazy experience. I think you guys, if you liked Rocky Horror, I think it's up your alley. And I think it's a very specific niche audience that he's going for. But throughout the interview, we also talk about his history with Saw. We kind of dive into some of his experiences. He has some great stories and reflections on that franchise. I think you'll learn something. If you're a fan of Saw, I think you'll learn some really cool stuff as well.
I especially liked where he talked about failure and how that's a positive thing instead of a negative thing. I really enjoyed that part of the conversation with us. So be sure those listen to keep an ear out for that specifically.
So keep your ear out for that. We are going to jump right into it. I'm sure you're already sick of hearing us. You didn't tune in to hear Aaron and Scott. But I do want to preface the interview with, it is a phone interview. And whenever we do a phone interview, we always like to remind you, you know, sound quality is not always optimal. It's not a direct connection, so to speak. So you will hear background noise. And he had some background noise. And you'll hear his son, actually, at the end of the interview, which just goes to prove he's a fantastic dad, that he, you know, he's like, hey, I can't ignore my son. Okay, so here we go. Here's the interview with, Alleluia, The Devil's Carnival director, Darren Lynn Bousman. Take a listen.
How's it going?
It's going great. How are you?
Good, man. Thank you.
I'm Aaron.
And I'm Scott.
Hey, guys. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thanks so much for coming on, man.
Of course.
We do have a couple listener questions we'll get into as we go, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
That a couple of them, of course, you know, revolve around Saw, which I'm sure you would expect. But there's a lot. There's some other stuff too. But before we get going, whenever I interview a filmmaker, the most important thing to me to know is how this itch to write and direct movies came to you in the first place.
You know, it's a hard question because I mean I think that I grew up in Midwest Kansas and I never was really good at school, wasn't great at math or social studies or science, and really wasn't good at sports. And I just couldn't wrap my head around why it mattered to me, like why I needed to know the things I needed to know for school. I just couldn't, it didn't click. And it clicked with some people, it just didn't click with me. But what did click with me was arts, things that actually made me feel something. And I think that I could give two shits about, you know, a specific event in history that didn't affect me per se. But if I saw a drawing or a comic book or a TV show, it would stay with me and it would affect me. And so I just found myself gravitating towards things that actually moved me or inspired me or affected me. And then I got into theater really young. My parents had me in an acting class when I was, 8 or 9 years old. And I was doing theater really young. So I think that I just fell in love with the idea of transporting myself to other worlds. I could put on a cape and I can become Dracula, or I could put on another thing and I was a tree. You know, it was ridiculous. I was in ridiculous plays being, you know, inanimate objects, and I loved it. And I also think I got off on the fact of the idea that people were watching, you know, the idea that I was on a stage and people were actually watching what I did and knowing that I had some sort of importance, because if I fucked it up, they were all going to know. And so there was a thrill and rush in that. So I just found very early on that I loved the arts. And then that, you know, I tried it when I went to college. I actually majored in a bunch of weird stuff, from anywhere from, I started off as an art history major, but then I moved over to Eastern Asian mythology. Mm. And I was in the same kind of boat, that I was like, why do I care about this? What do I really need this for? And so I decided, you know, one afternoon I called my parents up and I said, I'm wasting your money right now. I'm literally wasting your money. We have two options. You can continue to pay for me to go to school, and I'm going to walk out probably with a 1.0 GPA, and I will have learned nothing. Or we can put me in something that I actually care about. And my parents, as being badasses, said, don't waste our money. What do you want to do? And I said, I want to go to film school. I want to make movies. And so they sent me to film school, and I excelled. That was something that I cared about. I actually, it did inspire me. So when something inspires you, you're more akin to pay attention and give it more. So for me, it was just, I cared about it. And so when I was 20 years old, I left college. I dropped out my sophomore year in college and went to Orlando, Florida, and went to film school. And ironically, Orlando, the first thing I did when I was at film school was I got to direct the 35mm project, which only one student per class gets to do that, and I was picked to direct it, and I actually directed it as a musical. So I did my first musical in film school.
Man, you love musicals, don't you?
I do. People ask me a lot, how did you go from doing Saw to doing musicals? It's actually the reverse. I went from doing musicals to doing Saw, and then back to doing musicals.
Well, that's definitely, we're going to build up to that. I kind of want to go through some stuff before we get there.
Well, yeah, the question I had for you, Darren, is you talked a little bit about your history and what made you interested in filmmaking, but what was your first big break that got you into Hollywood movies?
It's a bunch of little breaks. I don't think there was ever one big break. That's wrong. So I was a PA on a bunch of small things, commercials and music videos, and then I eventually became a PA on X-Files, which was the first real job I had when I came to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. A funny story about how I actually got that, which is crazy. This is in the days of AOL. So I was 20 years old. I just turned 21. I was at film school, and everyone had an AOL account. Well, in AOL, there was Instant Messenger, and you could used to be able to search people's hobbies in Instant Messenger. So I would always, every night, I would come home, and I would search hobbies, and I would look for producer, filmmaker, director, and I would just randomly Instant message people. 99% of the time, they were either freaks or they were liars or they did not respond to me. But there was 1% of the time that people actually did respond and would humor me and talk to me. And one of the guys I met very early on was a producer. He'll never remember me, but a producer by the name of Harry Bring. Harry Bring, at the time, was one of the main producers on X-Files. And I think I was leaving Florida that next week, and I texted him, or IM'd him, and said, listen, you don't know me, I'm a director, I want to be a filmmaker, and I see you're a producer, is there anything you can give me? And he said, send me your resume the day you get into town. And so the first thing I did when I drove into town was I drove straight to where he was located and dropped off a resume. He called me in maybe 2 days later, and at this point I didn't know, but he was a producer on X-Files, and then he hired me on X-Files the next week, which I lasted about, 3 episodes before he fired me. But that was how I got started.
One of our listeners actually specifically asked about that story. He wanted to know, like, what happened, because I guess it's part of lore at this point, the X-Files story.
Yeah, I mean, I was a bad PA. I was terrible. I just didn't care. Like, here's the reality, and I don't recommend this for any filmmakers, but I'll just give you the 2 seconds of it. I was really cocky and arrogant when I came out to Los Angeles, and I think the reason why was I had just gotten out of going to film school, and I was kind of, I excelled at the film school that I went to, and I was very kind of weird, and I was very abrasive. And so I ended up always getting to do what I wanted to do. So I wanted to direct the 35mm film, and I did. And I wanted to make two other films when I was there, and I did. And so I had this reel, and when I came to Los Angeles, I thought I was the shit. And I guess delusionally thought that when I got out, people were going to open the, you know, open the gates and say, Darren, what is it you want to do? Do you want to direct the next Star Wars movie? Here you go. And so when I got out here and you're confronted with that reality of you're just a douchebag and your job is going to be to get coffee to every producer out there, I got upset. That's and funny. I got mad and I got depressed. And, you know, it, 1 month turned to 1 year, which turned numerous years of me doing what I consider to be degrading jobs. Mm-hmm. And not being paid for this degrading job. So I think on X-Files, I'd kind of, it was the very beginning of me starting to realize, wait, why am I sitting here working 22 hours a day holding people's coffee? This is ridiculous. And I didn't take the job very seriously, for starters. Secondly, I thought I was going to be a screenwriter. So I, every day, brought my laptop to work, and I would write on my screenplay. Well, that screenplay that I was writing while I was working on X-Files ended up becoming The Desperate, which eventually became Saw 2. In some respects, me being fired is absolutely what the universe had in store for me and had to happen for me to be a director today.
Wow. So it's all connected.
It is.
It is all connected. So then you ended up doing Saw 2, and of course, you know, like I said, several listeners' questions. So, but I have one of my own. Coming into the second movie, I mean, you already have an established universe. How was that for you to inject your own vision into the franchise?
Well, I think it's important to remember and know I had never directed anything before doing Saw 2. I mean, that's wrong. I directed some bad short films and a couple of really bad music videos, but I should not have directed Saw 2. There should have been no reason whatsoever that I should have directed Saw 2. I didn't have an awesome reel. I didn't have any reel, really. I mean, I never let anyone see those short films I did. Like, at the time, I thought they were awesome, but in retrospect, they were terrible. Mm-hmm. So part of what I wanted to do with The Desperate was I wanted to rebrand myself and rebuild myself up. And basically, I wrote what I considered to be the most shocking, hardcore, depressing script ever, realizing that if I wrote Bubblegum and I wrote Down the Middle, it would never be seen. Mm-hmm. So I knew that I had to write something that was so in-your-face shocking that people would laugh at it and give it to their friends, being like, dude, you've got to read the script called The Desperate. It's fucking crazy. So that's what I did. And when I wrote it, I thought that I was going to get a couple $100,000 to go off and make this as a short, or as my film. Never in a million years did I think that I was actually going to make Saw 2. So when it was bought, as The Desperate. It was never bought as Saw 2. And originally, Twisted Pictures was going to make it as its own movie. At this point, Saw had not come out yet. Saw had just gone to Sundance, and I think it was made for like $800,000. So Twisted Pictures wanted to follow that up with another very small movie. And I had gotten along with the producers and during our meeting, and I had convinced them to let me direct this. It wasn't until maybe 2 months after that that they actually, Lionsgate said, listen, this movie Saw at Sundance, it's the shit. We're going to have to make a sequel to this immediately, and we need it in 2 months or 3 months. They said, you know what, there's similarities in what Darren wrote to what this is. Let's transfer it to Saw 2. The irony of this whole thing was, or kind of to my good fortune, mm-hmm. When my lawyer made the deal for The Desperate, she attached me to The Desperate or any variation thereof as director. Well, when they changed The Desperate to Saw 2, I was automatically the director of it. Mm-hmm. So I didn't realize how big Saw was to be. I don't think anyone really did. So they just said to me, Darren, you're directing this as Saw 2 now, not The Desperate. And I got kind of mad originally because I was like, great, I'm going to be a sequel guy. No one's going to see this. And then Saw came out, and Saw was a juggernaut. It was huge. It was huge. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden it changed from being upset to being, oh, my God, they're going to fire me. I'm too small for this. But luckily I wasn't fired and they kept me on, and it was, you know, I have to thank for my career that I have right now.
That's a really interesting story, especially because it's got to be kind of almost bittersweet. I mean, you wrote this script your way and they obviously had to make some changes to fit it into the Saw universe, correct?
Yeah, there was a page one rewrite. In fact, there's very little similarities that's left from what I originally wrote to what it is now. my original idea was a bunch of people that played a game called The Minus Game, where people that were desperate in their lives basically willingly participated in an event which put them together in a house, and they had to kill each other before the night was over. Mm. But willingly, they were never put against their will. And then there was a twist at the very end that the police who are trying to find it, it's the same twist in the movie, the police that were trying to find it realized that what they were watching wasn't live. Spoiler alert for those who haven't seen Saw 2.
What? You ruined it.
But that was all that was there. Everything else got added after the fact. The idea of a serial killer, the idea of, you know, individual traps in the room, that was all something that we added after the fact. But originally, it was just people playing a game in a house that was being watched by police to be discovered later it wasn't live.
We got another question from one of our listeners here, Darren. His name is Joshua, and he wants to know how you planned out the Saw, or how planned out the Saw franchise was.
When I was on Saw 2, we were thinking 3 and 4. When I was doing 3, we were doing 4 and 5. And I think that I learned a lot from that about how to create a franchise, because I think that the thing which I think the franchises that work, there's forethought in what you're doing. You're not just thinking about where you are now. You're thinking about where you're going after the fact.
Sure.
So I think we would create threads making the Saw movies. Now, whether we paid those threads off, not necessarily, but we would have character names. Like, we would have a name. We'd have, like, one example, Tobin Bell would say someone's name. And then later on, he'd say an occupation of that person. And then we knew, okay, this is a character that we've now created in Saw 2. We can come back to in Saw 3 or 4. So we did, you know, there was a lot of that kind of stuff. That said, you know, I'd be lying if I said that when I made Saw 2, we knew where Saw 4 was going to go. We didn't. But, you know, there was, I will say that the Saw movies were made with a very loving group of producers who were very concerned about jumping the shark. Everyone was concerned about jumping the shark. So it was scrutinized up and down and up and down, up and down. Are we jumping the shark if we do this? So while there wasn't, I don't think, a master plan, there was a lot of thought that went into them all.
Josh Steinman wants to know what your favorite killer trap was from the Saw films. He wants to let you know that Saw 2 is far and away his favorite in the series, and he loves Mother's Day and Repo, too.
I think that I have two traps. I think for simplicity, Saw 2, the needle pit scene, just because it's so simple, and it's so, you know, it was not the engineering of the other future traps. There was something just very simplistic about it, and I think, in my opinion, it's the trap in Saw that always has people squirming in their seats when they see it. So I think the needle pit is one of them. I think the other one is the twisty trap. It was called the rack, where the guy got into it and it began to twist him 1 degree until every bone in his body broke.
Yeah.
I think why that one was is because it was a real trap. It really worked to a point of, you know, being a little scary. One of the mandates we set very early on in the Saw universe was everything had to work as we showed it working in the movie. So if the trap did something, the trap actually had to do that. And so we made sure that with the rack, it really twisted people. Well, before we put the actor in it, we had a stunt person get into it, and the gears turned so hard and so fast that, I mean, the stunt person had to quickly jump, like, to pull the trigger and stop it, because it would have broken arms and legs. So then we had to re-tinker with the trap to make it safe for an actor to get into. So I was always shocked and kind of in awe of that trap, because it really was what we show it doing in the movie.
Did you ever put somebody you didn't like from the crew into one of these traps and just threaten them a little bit?
No, but I did do, I posted on this on Facebook last month, and then I took it down, being like, you know what, that makes me look like an asshole, but I'll tell you, because I think it's funny. Angus McFadden and I on Saw 3 did not get along at all. Now, we ended up becoming really good friends, and he ended up doing another movie with me after the fact, but when we first came on, I'm not sure if he was familiar with what the Saw franchise actually was. Mm-hmm. He probably was told it's a horror film, and it's psychological, and blah, blah, blah. Well, then he realized how kind of gross it was, and one of his early days in it was he had to be in the pig trap scene where the pigs were, you know, blending and pig slop was being thrown on a drowning man. Yeah. So he looks at it and says, and the scene was Angus had to run in and save the guy who was drowning, and he looks at it and is like, you're not going to put pig guts on me, are you? And obviously in the scene, that's 100% what we were going to do. And it wasn't real pig guts. It was like gelatin and other
shit.
And I said, Angus, yes, it's in the script. Of course we are. And he's like, well, I'm not doing that. That's disgusting. And I was like, Angus, we have to. And he said, can't you shoot it from my back and have someone else do it? And you could tell he was really uncomfortable about this. And so I said, okay, Angus, fine. We won't put it on you. And it was the only way that he would kind of go on with the scene. Well, the second he gets in the trap, immediately I said, fuck it, hit him with the pig guts. And so we start rolling camera, and there was a noise before the pig guts came that kind of alerted the actor this was about to happen. You see his horrified reaction turn, his eyes get wide, and he screams, no! Well, that was really pig guts hitting him, stayed in the movie as that actual moment where he got hit by them, with an actual real reaction of Angus McFadden being furious that he was about to get hit with all of this pig shit.
Oh, that's awesome.
he got really mad afterwards, obviously. That was kind of a dick move to do. But
did he get you back?
I apologized profusely, and we became friends after that. But that was another fun one.
Did he get you back?
No. Well, yes and no. He's a prankster on set, but I don't think anything is going to beat or top what I did.
No.
You're probably right there. We do have one more listener question about Saw, and I promise you it's the last one.
No worries.
Suraj Prakash from our group here wants to know, first off, a big fan of Saws 2 and 3, but his question is, when writing and directing a horror thriller like those films, what's your technique like? Are the set pieces driving the story, or are the characters and their motives driving?
It's a good question. And actually, when we made Saw 3 and 4, the traps are the last thing to be thought of or implemented. It's, we actually put holes in the script that says trap to go here. And we didn't know what we were going to do in some instances until a few days or weeks before we actually started filming. So the traps actually were the last thing that came together. I think it was always Tobin Bell first, Jigsaw first, the twist second, and the traps third.
Wow.
That's really interesting.
Is that because of the turnaround? Because they were popping them out like every year for a good time? Is that why?
Yeah, I mean, it became harder and harder to find innovative ways to kill people and without jumping the shark. And so, specifically on Saw 4, I remember that when I shot Saw 4, I was really concerned because in the way the schedule was set up, the first 10 days had no violence in it. It was just people talking, and I was terrified that we were just doing people talking. And then eventually, after like day 10 or 11, we started doing the traps. But traps always is the last thing that went into the movies. And also, I think the other reason why is it gave us more time to flesh them out. They weren't just thrown at the screen and hope they worked. We had time to actually pick them apart and say, oh, is this the best version of the trap it can be?
Okay, so you did great work with the Saw series. I mean, after 4, I think it kind of went a certain direction and it wasn't up. And one of the most successful runs of a horror director ever, if you really look at it. What made you? It's factual. You don't have to thank me. You did it. what made you decide it's time to move on? I gotta either leave this universe or I gotta expand my own horizons.
I mean, to kind of go. We started off originally with, I never wanted to do horror films. That was never why I came to Los Angeles. I didn't come here to go make horror films. I came here to make musicals. Mm-hmm. And more, I think even more importantly than that, I found myself getting lazy. Like extremely lazy, because I think I became so comfortable in the Saw universe. I knew that I would never really fail. I knew that the Saw movies were a juggernaut, and Lionsgate needed the Saw movies at that time. And so even if I completely shat the bed and it was a terrible movie, they would fix it. They would fix it in post. They would fix it in sound. They would go back and reshoot stuff. You know, there was not the risk anymore. And I think that part of being an artist is knowing it's okay to fail. And not only it's okay to fail, but actually failing again and again and again and again. And I can say this right now, and I've said this numerous times throughout my career, I am a failure. I have failed a million times more than I've succeeded, a million times more. But you guys only hear about the times that I succeed. You hear about the Saw 2s and the Saw 3s, but you don't hear about the 30 movies I've been fired off of. You don't hear about the 90 scripts that couldn't get sold. You don't hear about all of those failures that happen. You hear about the success. And it is because of the failures that I think I've been able to succeed. And with the Saw movies, it was becoming harder and harder to fail. And it was, I became cocky again. I became so comfortable in my own skin that it wasn't a challenge for me. And, you know, I probably would have a much better life if I continued to make the Saw movies. I'd definitely be more financially secure. I'd probably be directing bigger movies. And it's a hard thing as well now. All the people that I started with, Tyler Perry, Eli Roth, James Gunn, James Wan, they've all gone on to do huge $100 million movies. And we were all started at the same time. We all started at that exact same time. Mm-hmm. And now I'm still doing the same small movies. I think partially because I took a risk. I didn't play the safe card and say, I'm going to keep making $3 million films or $4 million films. I said, I'm going to go make a rock opera with Paris Hilton. That probably threw me off my trajectory, completely off my trajectory. That said, I would do the exact same thing if I had a chance to again, because it's not about taking the safe road for me. It's about doing, as an artist, what I think the best road is for me. And I want to make movies that I want to see, and I wanted to see something weird and unique and different. And that's what I did. So I can stand by those decisions now in retrospect, but probably that's the reason that I'm not making those huge movies like everyone else is.
Well, let me ask you, because you mentioned that we don't hear about the spectacular failure, so to speak. What is the most spectacular? I mean, the one firing off a movie where you were just devastated the most, I guess.
Well, I mean, I can say that my biggest failure was 11/11. And I think that was from a few different reasons. Number one is it was a movie that I shouldn't have made. I was desperate to make a movie, and I did not have the proper budget to do it correctly. I said I would do it, and I was, again, I wanted to work. I wanted to go to Spain and shoot it, even though there were red flags all over the place. There wasn't enough money. I didn't speak the language. There was all of these red flags, but I did it anyway. And then when I got out there were more red flags, and I continued to move on and on and on. And it's a spectacular failure if you watch it. You know, one of the things that was probably the hardest for me was it was the first time I was taken off a movie. Not taken off a movie, but another editor was brought in to finish the film that was not supervised necessarily by me. Great dude. Guy's an awesome. He's a director as well. But I was on pre-production on The Barons, and I wasn't over to oversee it as I should have. And when I saw the finished product of the movie, it really did not resemble the film that I set off to make at all. And then it's released, and then you have no control once it's released. It just looks to the audience that, hey, this is Darren Bowson's movie. Mm-hmm. It stopped being my movie months and months and months and months before it was released. But you have to sit there, and you have to take that failure. So I think, you know, there are things like 11/11, which are travesties for me as an artist. But then there are movies that you don't even hear about. I've spent years on projects that end up falling through and never get made. And so I bet you this year alone there's been five or six movies that I've been attached to that have just fallen through and haven't gone through.
Oh, man, Hollywood.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Darren, you've done several other films, and I know Aaron's a big fan of Mother's Day. And like you mentioned, 11/11 and The Barons, but what's been the most challenging aspect about filmmaking outside of such a large franchise, you know, both good and bad?
I think perceptions are a huge deal, and that I think that people believe, oh, well, Darren did the Saw franchise. He's got $1 million, and he's got it made, and blah, 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 blah. Every day is a struggle. I mean, every day I wake up and consider just becoming an alcoholic and crying in the bathtub and not leaving the house. It's not easy. It's not at all. People have asked me a lot if I would how to describe what the filmmaking process is really like, what it's really like. And I would the closest thing that I would compare it to is House of Cards. I don't know if you've ever seen House of Cards, but
absolutely.
the character Frank Underwood that Kevin Spacey plays is the closest thing that I can say, for me at least, what Hollywood is like. It's politics. It's all politics. It's political 24/7. Being a filmmaker is 99% politics, 1% creativity. It's knowing who to say what to and who to play against who and how to tell certain people things without offending them, but then knowing that these two people are like an example, like one of the last films I did, I won't say which one, the lead actor and lead actress hated each other, literally hated each other, and how to be able to play both of them against each other so I can get a performance out of them. Mm-hmm. It's not fun. I think people have this assumption that movie making is fun. It's not. What's fun is at this point right now when the movie's done and you can look back at it and be proud of it and promote it. But the actual process of getting a film made, it's arduous, and I've lost years off my life and hair off my head, and it's a harsh thing. And that's why I love The Devil's Carnival, is because for me, that's when I actually have fun, because I'm working with my friends. I'm working with artists who I respect and admire, and that politics and that political shit is gone, and we're actually just making art. And it's become harder and harder for filmmakers to just go and make art without having to cast who the studio wants cast and how to, you know, whitewash the script so it makes sense for middle America. I could give two fucks if my movie makes sense. The Devil's Carnival is absurd. It's completely absurd. It's crazy. It's got David Hasselhoff singing in it. It's ridiculous. And that's why I love it, is because no one else would make a movie like this, and that's why I absolutely had to make a movie like this.
Okay, so now we're getting into that uncharted territory, Repo, the genetic opera. This is like your first experiment with this insane touring movie concept. I think everybody was probably, like you said, expecting you to be staking out Marvel's office or something. But instead, here you are. You're creating this brand of event filmmaking, rounding up Paul Sorvino, Paris Hilton, Alexa Vega. I mean, it's really got quite a cast. What really spoke to you about doing that?
For me, musicals have always affected me. And I think that when you got to figure how important or how much music actually plays in our everyday life. You get in the car and you put on your iPad, your iPod, and you're listening to music. It's what we do in our pastimes. It's what we do when we go to the gym or when we go out walking. It's what we put on in parties to basically ease us. And I think that for me, I have the same feeling about movies as well. Movies inspire me and they move me. And so being able to combine the two of those things and doing it successfully for me, it connects with me and it stays with me much longer than just narrative storytelling. Mm-hmm. Growing up as a kid, I was obsessed with Rocky Horror Picture Show. I was obsessed with Jesus Christ Superstar, obsessed with Phantom of the Paradise and Tommy and all these other movies. And I think that because it was so weird and so out of the box and spectacular in the most absurd way, that I remembered those films. I didn't remember other movies. Like, for example, like I loved Weekend at Bernie's, but I couldn't tell you two things about that film outside of it was about a dead guy who they moved around, because it was a single-serving type film. I loved it. I can say it's probably one of my favorite comedies, but it didn't stay with me after I left. Musicals and weird absurdity things like this stayed with me. And so I wanted to do that. I wanted to do something that was a train wreck, a beautiful disaster that people would talk about and be polarizing, which I think we succeeded at. This movie is not for everybody. In fact, a lot of people despise the film with a passion. I remember that one of the best and worst moments of my life was Ben Lyons, who had his TV show called At the Movies, network TV show. Started off his year-end review of not only the worst movie of the year and running for the worst movie of all time, Repo, the Genetic Opera. And I thought that was equal parts awesome and infuriating.
I could see that.
But I would much rather make polarizing films than films that were just kind of down the middle. So we set off to make what I love, the kind of movies that I wanted to see.
But people really bought into it, though. I mean, there are people lining up and dressing up as their favorite characters and replicating that success, right? I mean, across the country.
Yeah, it did. But it didn't start off like that. It was a failure. It was the biggest commercial failure. I think we made Repo for $12 million, and it was released in two theaters. It was a tremendous failure. Mm-hmm. It became a cult fan phenomenon after we decided to take it on the road. And I think that's where the kind of birth of all of this came from, was the idea of using a road show to find our fan base. And I'm actually in the middle right now of writing a blog about this exact thing, but kind of our task as filmmakers and artists is to be able to have your art seen at any cost and be able to stand by that art at any cost. Mm-hmm. And I think that with Repo, when I heard it was going to be destined for straight to video, and this was in 2008. 2008 straight to video is different than 2015 straight to video.
Yeah,
2008
yeah.
straight to video is a kiss of death. You're gone.
Yeah.
I couldn't handle that. I had worked too hard. Too many people had sacrificed too much for that. So we decided, let's tour it. Let's take it on the road. Let's go everywhere with this movie and see if we can find our fan base. And we did. We found it. We found out that there was a fan base for it. And these fan base, they were passionate, and they were willing and eager to eat this type of film up. So it was kind of in that van ride to all these cities that we birthed The Devil's Carnival, which is, what if we made a movie that was specifically about the experience of going? It was specifically about, you know, that love that I had for the theater when I grew up, and that, you know, I think I've kind of lost that a little bit. Movies have become these things that, you know, they're churned out, and they are there's nothing magical anymore about me seeing a movie. I think the last time that I felt any sort of magic in a movie theater was when I saw Amelie. This is a crazy, it was my first year in Los Angeles, and I was driving down the street, and I saw this independent movie theater showing Amelie. And I didn't know what Amelie was, and so I went in there, and I sat down by myself in the theater. No one else was there. And this movie came on, and it was magical. And it was just me and a thing of popcorn, and I felt almost like a religious experience. There was something magical about it. I don't get that when I go to movies much, but I got it then. And so I wanted to make going to a movie theater magical and cool and different and unique and something that people talked about. And so we decided, how do we make a movie that will do that? How do we engage the audience to be active as opposed to passive when they watch the movie? So we created a film that would embrace that kind of idea. And that's kind of my last 5 years I've been doing.
I just love that Amelie is almost the inspiration for the Devil's Carnival. That's I love that.
Yeah, it's just about the idea that movie theaters used to be a magical place to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that they've just changed a little bit. It's not the same as it used to be, especially when I was a kid. So the idea behind the Devil's Carnival was to make that experience of going to a theater magical.
I agree with you, man. I'm a huge advocate of going to the theater, and it has totally changed since we were kids.
I went to the movie theater recently, and I went and saw, I'm trying to think what the last movie I saw was. Well, I saw Mad Max, which was fantastic, and that was a magical experience,
yeah.
Seeing it at the Cinerama Dome. But I was in Toronto recently, and I went to the theater, and it literally was Chevrolet ads. It was an ad for a blender. There was ads for Facebook, and it was all of this commercialism being shoved down my throat as I'm sitting into the movie theater waiting to watch this movie. And then there's 11 minutes of other ads that come on before that, before even the previews come on.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't cool like it used to be. It wasn't like I was excited about the lights to dim and to sit in a theater and have this experience. It was I was being fed all of this crap that I didn't care about. And that's why most people stay home now. Like, that's why Netflix and DirecTV and all these other places, in my opinion, are so prevalent. Why would I leave my house when I have a huge TV screen with surround sound and I can watch most movies, in the comfort of my home with my kid and my wife and my dog? We have to give people a reason to leave the theater, to leave their house and go to the theater. We have to offer them something they're not going to get at their house. And that's what we're trying to do with Devil's Carnival, give you an experience that you cannot have in your living room.
Well, now that you brought up Devil's Carnival, I want to ask you, is this a sequel or is it more of an expansion of the previous film?
It's a direct sequel. It takes place seconds after the first film, but it stands alone. You will not have to have seen the first film to understand what's going on in Devil's Carnival 2. Again, it's kind of a mishmash of crazy, weird, zany, undefinable shit. So, if people have not seen the first film and see Devil's Carnival 2 is coming to their town, I would not let that stop you, because you can completely understand and get this film without having any context of the first film.
What's your quick pitch? I mean, in terms of, like, how would you sell the movie to... Here's what it's about, because it's a really hard movie to explain.
The first film was Aesop's Fables, morality tales about three sinners who are sent to hell, and they embody different Aesop's fables. And so it was basically the devil giving these morality tales in hell. But the kind of broader story was about the devil's kind of wanting to overthrow heaven, overthrow God. This film is about the war that's about to take place between heaven and hell. And it starts with Lucifer basically firing the first shot, which is he is sending back condemned souls from hell back to heaven. So the very first scene of the movie is these condemned souls that were all sent to hell going back to heaven. And so imagine if, right now in the world, people live by some code with the thought of, if I live a righteous lifestyle, I'll go to heaven. But imagine you can live a horrible lifestyle. You can do whatever you want. You can sin. You can do whatever it is you want it to do, and you still get to go to heaven.
Souls.
And so it's basically God's ultimate, or the devil's ultimate, fuck you, which is, I'm just going to send your condemned souls back to heaven, and you can't do a shit about it. And so the story of Devil's Carnival 2 is the story of Lucifer sending back condemned souls. And more importantly, you get to see heaven and the inner workings of heaven. And heaven is not this glorious, beautiful place, as we've been led to believe. It's a dark, almost sweatshop factory of horribleness that takes place to everyone that lives there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of fun because we flip what everyone thinks heaven and hell is. Hell is the awesome rock and roll, punk rock kind of lifestyle, and heaven is this oppressive regime.
I want you in charge of hell, because that sounds a lot more fun right? than everything I've been through.
Darren, you mentioned Rocky Horror a little while ago, and I'm going to be straight with you. I hadn't seen that until a couple years ago. I'm kind of the one known in the group that has seen the least amount of movies because of my age. I'm a little bit younger than the rest of the guys. But we recently had a screening of it on Halloween in a local theater here, and people just loved it. It was a fun experience, especially for someone like me that had never seen it. How do you know what are the right chords to strike to get people that excited for something new? Is it a lot of trial and error?
I think that why Rocky Horror and why most cult films succeed, why others fail, is people try to manufacture cult. And they say, well, we're going to do this, this, and this, and this. I think in some extent there is a formula about how to do it. I don't think you can do it with every movie. I think why Rocky Horror succeeds and why Repo and Devil's Carnival has succeeded is they are so extreme. There's nothing subtle about them. There's nothing subtle about Rocky Horror Picture Show whatsoever. It is extreme. It is flamboyant. It is over the top. The characters are over the top. The costumes are over the top. Everything is just extreme. But I think the fandom and why the fans have embraced it so much is that everyone identifies with a different character. Identify with Tim Curry as the, you know, Dr. Frankfurter, or to Brad or Janet or Riff Raff. There's so many different people that you can identify with in it because they are so specific. They are the hunchback. They are the young, the young ingenue. They are the crazy transvestite. They're so specific that different people can identify with different characters. And I think that we did the same thing with Repo and the Devil's Carnival. There's so many unique cosplay opportunities, so many different makeup and prosthetics that they aren't the same. None of the characters in this movie are the same. They are so utterly and uniquely different that people can pick who they are. I'm like Lucifer. Well, I'm like Alexa Vega's character. Well, no, I'm like Ogre. I'm like Bill Moseley. And then they can dress up like those characters, and they can show off their own cosplay skills. So I think that has a great deal to do with it. And also, I think the music, in the case of Rocky Horror Picture Show, it's awesome. It's still groundbreaking. I still listen to Rocky Horror Picture Show consistently.
Mm-hmm. So do I. I've always been a big fan of it. You have Paul Sorvino, Barry Bostwick, Adam Pascal from Rent, Dayton Kelly from Sons of Anarchy, and even Hassel DeHoff to be in this.
Yeah.
What is your secret, man? You rustled up a great cast, which I can't imagine is an easy sell. Come to our God and Hell musical.
And musicians. You got Tech N9ne and Jimmy from Mindless Self-Indulgence. How did you get all of those people?
You know what? It was the easiest casting we've ever done, because I think when you're going out on a movie like Abattoir or Saw, you're trying to sell something that is somewhat mainstream, in the fact that, you know, Saw is a dime a dozen now. There's so many horror films. There are so many action movies. There's so many drama movies. There's not that many rock and roll operas being made. There's not that many rock and roll musicals. So when you go to someone like this, you have immediately put yourself into a league of a very niche market. How many times does, you know, Jimmy Urine get offered to come be in a rock and roll musical? How many times does Paul Sorvino get told, hey, come play God? Mm-hmm. So I think that it's an easier sell in some respects, because it's not something they've heard before, where a lot of these things have been things they've been asked a million times. You know, hey, come play the mafia boss, come play the whatever. But there's not that isn't the case with this. It's not the case. People don't get offered to play these roles.
Wow. Well, good job, man, because you got a solid cast there.
Thank you.
So what is the plan and then the goal for this movie? I mean, best case scenario, where do you want this to lead? Do you want like another film? Do you want several? Do you want it to be
The idea originally was for us to do a TV series or a ongoing series of these, all a, you know, American Horror Story, where there would be a weekly series. I mean, kind of our thing is this: Glee was extremely popular. We are the anti-Glee. And for everyone that loves Glee, there's someone that hates it. Mm-hmm. And I think that we are the counter-programming to that type of show. We are doing the dark, satanic, rock and roll musical. So that's, I mean, to me, that's what it is. But you know, I don't really have an answer to that because I just want to keep making cool things. Hopefully we get to make more of these, but if not this, then something else that's equally as weird and crazy and cool. That's what I want to do.
I got to tell you, Darren, when I watched the trailer for this film, for The Devil's Carnival, I watched it and at the end I said, man, this feels like if Moulin Rouge were set at a circus in hell. That's like the vibe I got from that.
Can I use that as our poster?
Yeah,
that's a,
please
that's
do.
An awesome description. No, that's, you know, that's what it is. I love Moulin Rouge. I love Baz Luhrmann. And I think that it is very, that's pretty much kind of what it is.
Awesome.
That's fantastic. That is.
Well, can you tell us about some other projects you're working on? I know you mentioned Abattoir earlier, but also you got The Dwelling in the works?
Yeah, The Dwelling is actually a sequel to Abattoir, which has already been kind of greenlit after they saw the early cut of the first film. Abattoir is my kind of take on a haunted house film. It's an idea I've had for a long time, but basically the premise is a man who's also played by Dayton Cowley. So he goes and he takes, if someone died in some kind of horrible circumstance, he goes to the house and buys the house. So if someone slits the wrist in a bathtub, if someone hangs themselves on a chandelier, if someone was killed in a brutal murder home invasion, he goes and he buys the house, and then he rips the crime scene out of it. And it's about an investigative journalist who begins to uncover that he's not only ripping the rooms out, he's building a house of just these rooms.
Oh, wow.
And the story follows why he's building the house and this woman's kind of investigation to figure out why he's doing it. And things go from bad to worse.
So the test screenings have been going pretty fantastic.
We only screened it one time. We only screened it to the buyers, the guys who originally financed the movie, and they liked it enough to quickly move ahead to the sequel.
Wow.
So that's cool. And then I also have Tales of Halloween coming out this year, which is the anthology film from Adam Girash, Mike Mendez, Dave Parker, Paul Sollett, Lucky McGee, Neil Marshall, Axel Carolyn. It's Andrew Cash, 10 directors, or 11 filmmakers, 10 shorts, all set around Halloween night. We just premiered at Fantasia in Montreal to great reviews. So that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'm actually I'm really looking forward to that one. I think it was supposed to come out in the middle of October.
October 16th, I think, yeah.
Oh, I really want to see that, so I'm looking forward to that.
It's a lot of fun. I mean, it kind of harkens back to some of my favorite movies, like The Creepshow, Tales from the Dark Side, even Tales from the Crypt.
Well, you ever want to come back and promote that one, and feel free, man. I love Halloween movies. Love.
Definitely. I'd love to.
We do have one more listener question for you before we let you go, Darren.
Sure.
Sean McGuire wants to know, what's your definition of a perfect horror movie?
I think one that makes you uncomfortable, but also makes you see things in a different way, that challenges the way that you view the world. You know, some of my favorite horror films, I don't think most people would consider them horror. Like, I think Requiem for a Dream is one of the most horrific films ever made.
I agree.
It's not a horror film, per se, but it brings light to addiction in a way that is so absolutely horrific that it's a hard movie for me to watch. I think for me, horror is just something, it's a way to make you feel anxiety and fear and stays with you. I think part of a good horror film, it's got to stay with you. I thought about Requiem for a Dream for months and months and months after I saw it. And I think that that, to me, is a good horror film is not something that is easily forgettable after you leave the theater.
I'm still disturbed by basically the last 5 minutes of that movie.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. Yeah, it's awesome.
Well, as we thanks for coming on. I know we have to wrap it up. But how can people find this? Because I know you're really rolling this out unconventionally. So how can people find The Devil's Carnival?
Well, there's a couple different ways. I think first off, follow us on Facebook, The Devil's Carnival, The Devil's Carnival. Our website, thedevilscarnival.com, it lists all of our dates and stops, and we're continually adding new stops as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, it will end up online. It will be on Netflix. It will be on iTunes. It will be on all of that. And the movie is awesome as itself. I mean, I encourage people to go out to the actual experience because it's a different way to watch a film in a concert-like setting. But you know, just look for it on iTunes soon. But I encourage you to please follow us, and if we're coming to your city, please show up.
Oh, absolutely. We're definitely going to do it. As soon as you come to Chicago, we're going to check that out.
Excellent. We'll be there in about 3 weeks.
Oh, we got to do it.
Got to do it.
Excellent. We'll let us know. We'll get you guys in.
Okay. Anything
else? I really appreciate it.
Oh, man. Thanks for coming on. We really do appreciate it. I know it sounds like you got your hands full, literally.
Yeah, I do right now. Thanks, guys.
Saying.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Darren.
Take care.
All right, bye.
All right, bye-bye. There you go, guys. That was our interview with Darren Lynn Bousman. What do you think, Scott?
I thought it was a lot of fun. He was a really interesting guy to talk to, very well-versed.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stories or some listener questions, which I definitely appreciate him taking time to answer. You know, he was here to talk about Alleluia, the Devil's Carnival. That was his number one promotion. And in case you didn't realize, he was more than open to talk about the rest of his career, which mm-hmm. I thought was really insightful for listeners.
Absolutely.
Okay, and as we wrap up, I want to make sure you know where you can find Darren. He does have a blog, like he talked about during the interview, DarrenLynnBousman.com. That's DarrenLynnBousman.com. And he's on Twitter, Darren_Bousman. So that's @Darren_Bousman. So be sure to check him out there as well. And go to thedevilscarnival.com if you want to find out more about that, which you do, because Scotty and I, we're going to go check it out.
I think we have to.
I'm
really interested.
We have to see it. So we will check it out, and we will definitely report to you, back to you, on what that experience, not the movie, the experience was. I think we can all attest that's
I'll bring the rice.
You're just going to bring the only thing you know about how to do this? Anything you want to say in parting, Scott?
I just really appreciate him taking the time to do it. He seemed like a real genuine guy about his art, and I hope he does really well, and I want to see what he does in the future.
Yeah, looking forward to it, Darren. Thanks for coming by. Remember, guys, you can throw The Hollywood Outsider on your tablet or mobile device of choice, and we have either an Apple or an Android app, whichever one you prefer. You can also subscribe and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, or through whatever podcast app you currently use. Our normal show has a new episode every Tuesday and is available at thehollywoodoutsider.com. Thanks again, Scott, for coming.
Thanks for having me.
And remember, everybody, the next time you go to a theater, buy popcorn.